People were so few on the downtown streets. When Johnny May had gone across to the Howard Theater for a musical show or over to Griffith Stadium for a baseball game, the streets there were thronged with black and brown and yellow people, as well as whites. The U Street thoroughfare was thick with people. But on the streets of downtown, dark faces were scarce. Gladys Perryman descended from the train and seemed to glide through the station without touching the marble floor. Her tall, willowy frame, outfitted in a chic white wool suit of recent fashion, caused the welcoming committee to sigh and adjust their clothes, smoothing and patting themselves. Miss Iola drew up with pride, pulling in her derriere and hoisting her breasts high with dignity. Asa Perryman's girl was already a sensation, and she had not yet set foot in Georgetown. All eyes went to Gladys's head. On it, she wore a jaunty, crescent-shaped cloche, stuck through with a low-hanging turkey feather. The hair that was visible beneath the hat was arranged in shiny, frothy curls. Touching a white handkerchief to her throat, Gladys said, "How do you do?" The committee giggled and answered with a round of, "How do?" A small, enigmatic smile came to rest on Gladys Perryman's lips. Ms. Iola stepped forward and, looking upward into Gladys's pretty face, took her by the shoulders and kissed each of her cheeks. Each woman stepped forward as she was introduced and smiled warmly. Johnny May and Pearl curtsied. Gladys was pleased with her reception. It had been worth it to drain her savings for the new suit and hat. A stunning appearance was worth every penny it took for a woman in the business of making other women beautiful. As Madam C.J. Walker herself said, "Meticulous grooming is a beautician's best advertisement." The women allowed Ms. Iola to take Gladys's arm, while several of them grabbed up her luggage. Johnny May and Pearl tussled over a small train bag and ended with Pearl relinquishing it to Johnny May when her mama chastised her with her eyes. Flanked by her coterie of admirers, Gladys crossed Union Station's waiting room floor with head held high and ambition soaring. Gladys had certainly caused a ripple among the women who came to welcome her at the station. She took this to mean that the Negro women of Georgetown were ready to buy the magic she could let loose from jars and combs. She would set the tone. She, Gladys Perryman, graduate of Lelia College in New York City, would lead them out of the backwater of beauty culture and into the promised land. Gladys Perryman was a marvel to Johnny May. It would be silly to say that the turkey feather was the thing that had done it, but it was the thing that had captured her attention, that made an impression on her. That large turkey feather, sticking through the hat at such an angle, was so lovely and daring. Johnny May had never seen a woman so vibrant. Her own mother was pretty, everyone thought so, and there were other pretty women in Georgetown. But no one of them had the look that Gladys Perryman had when she first appeared at Union Station. She was striking, and she looked as if she'd planned it that way. That was it. She wasn't just pretty by accident. Gladys Perryman was beautiful on purpose. And Johnny May could tell that all of the women in the welcoming group were envious of Gladys Perryman's fine clothes and bearing. The whole of the ride home on the streetcar, Gladys could well have been the queen of Georgetown for the fawning attention she got from the committee. And she sat straight and dignified, wearing white gloves with pearl buttons on the delicate hands that rested one atop the other near her left knee. Dr. Marvin Tyler could have sent his daughter Sari to Ms. Jackson or someone or other to get her hair pressed. Or he certainly could have sent her across town in Washington City to a hairdresser. But there was some feeling akin to shame that washed over him when he considered it, and he reproached himself for feeling shame in connection with so small a thing. He was further ashamed of feeling ashamed of Sari's hair. He knew that some portion of this feeling sprang from Sari herself, who seemed so aware of his feelings and stoked the flames of this shame with her eyes and her manner. The new hairdresser, or beautician, as she advertised herself, gave the impression of being bound by a professional ethic of secrecy. The neatly lettered sign said simply, "Gladys Perryman, beautician," and conveyed a sense of confessional sanctity, a solemn code of confidentiality. She would work her magic and not tell her tricks. Being used to his wife's light cream color, the doctor was surprised that he was enamored of Gladys Perryman's skin, which was the color of strong pekoe tea, the color of some leaves in autumn. Being used to the delights of his wife's long, straight hair, he was surprised that his eyes fancied Gladys Perryman's glossy black hair. Gladys ushered Sari into the kitchen at the back of her aunt and uncle's house. "We'll take our time, doctor," she said, turning to the doctor, who had started to follow his daughter into the kitchen. He stood looking directly into Gladys's eyes, wanting to bring his hands up from his sides and touch her face. "She's a big girl, doctor. I'll send her home when she's done," Gladys said as she accompanied him back to the front door. He paused just inside the parlor doorway and proffered a dollar bill. "Children are only 50 cents, doctor. I'll do my best." "Yes, but please, I have no change." "Then you won't owe me for the next time," she said, smiling sweetly and taking the bill. Surprised at himself, Dr. Tyler rubbed the brim of his hat between his fingers like a schoolboy and wondered where the feeling of excitement in Gladys Perryman's presence could be coming from. His voice was scratchy and uncertain when he said, "Thank you, Miss Perryman. I have my calls to make." He turned and left. Gladys gave Sari's scalp a vigorous washing over a tub in her aunt's kitchen. However, the brushing and oiling and pressing was done with a gentleness to which Sari was unaccustomed. Gladys encouraged the girl while she worked, chirping, "You've got a nice suit of hair. It just needs cultivating. We'll work on it." Sari's hair was as close to a rat's nest as any she'd seen. But Gladys was excited by the challenge of creating beauty out of the mess on top of the girl's head. Sari flinched when she felt the heat of the hot comb near her ears. Gladys was careful, though, and no streams of hot grease slid down her neck or seared her ears. Sari became relaxed after a while, and though she didn't hold out much hope that her head would finally look like Miss Perryman's, she prayed fervently that it would. Sari's hair looked perfectly presentable for the first time ever when Gladys Perryman finished with her that day. On subsequent visits, Sari begged her father to be allowed to go every week. Gladys built upon the cultivation she had begun in the first visit. She pressed and brushed the hair away from the girl's hairline and plaited it tightly in two braids. After several months, Sari's hair grew and thickened and became lovely. So much had been done with so little that other women and girls were heartened. If Gladys Perryman could work a miracle on Sari Tyler's head, then she could fix anyone's. It was the best advertising Gladys could have wanted. Gladys built a clientele so quickly that she had to work in her aunt's kitchen every day but Sunday. Within weeks, she began to dream of having her own shop. Wednesday evening and all day Thursday, the kitchen mechanic's day off were busiest. The muscles in Gladys's upper arms would be cramping on her by the time the last of Thursday's heads was done. But this schedule gave her the luxury of resting late in the morning, especially on Fridays. She relished this time when she could take a long, perfumed bath while her aunt and uncle were out working. She could spend time oiling her skin and pressing and curling her own hair. She could loll around and dream about having her own storefront on the avenue. She could put on a pretty dress and take a parasol and walk down Wisconsin Avenue in the late afternoon, coyly shopping for vegetables and fruit. Chapter 17. The breeze that was stirring was foul-smelling and blew up from the Hopfenmeyer rendering plant near the Potomac River's edge. The air was noxious. Alice felt like a rag doll as she walked up Wisconsin Avenue to the St. Pierre's house. When she reached the crest of the hill at Wisconsin and R Streets, she paused to huff and blow and dab at her forehead. A harsh truth had to be faced. The St. Pierre's household accounts were going unpaid. This was the pitfall of working for one family. When their fortunes turned sour, your bread was likely to go unbuttered. Alice entered the house by the back kitchen door as usual. And as usual, she listened for Alexis's footsteps coming toward the kitchen. In happier times, Alexis was accustomed to coming into the kitchen as soon as Alice arrived. She would begin their day together with a cheery greeting. Alice had liked her for that. Throughout the day, Alexis kept company with Alice when she was not engaged in her club meetings and social obligations. The house was quiet and dark when Alice arrived. The drapes in the front room were closed against the noxious air outside, and no lamps were lit. Though it was nearly an hour before she heard Alexis descend the stairs, Alice knew she was in the house. When Alexis came into the kitchen, she was wearing a dull pink wrapper. Her hair was gathered messily into a ponytail, and dried material was caked at the corners of her eyes. The sight of her shocked Alice. Alexis had always comported herself with circumspection about her clothes and hygiene. And though she had always been friendly and easygoing, she was never anything less than properly dressed and ladylike. Alexis had never been one for suffering vapors or lolling about in her nightclothes. She was energetic, and she enjoyed her activities, her gardening and her knitting and her club meetings. "Miss St. Pierre, you feeling all right?" Alice asked with genuine concern. If she was sick, it had come on suddenly. Yesterday, she had been quiet and threatening tearful, but not ill. Alexis didn't reply. She pulled her wrapper tightly about her neck and sat in one of the kitchen chairs. "You'll feel better if you have a cup of tea." Alice put a pot of water on the boil, dunked and wrung a face cloth in warm water, and bathed Alexis's face. She must be coming down with a croup. That could explain her disheveled appearance. After Alice had swabbed the corners of Alexis's eyes and rubbed the face cloth over her face and down her neck and at her nape and across the exposed areas of her chest, Alexis still sat unmoving in the chair. Suddenly, she began to shake and sweat. Alice tried to mop her dry. Then shaking and sweating continued and tears flowed. Tears broke over her breast like beads from a broken strand. She could not be calmed. Alice propped Alexis against the back of the chair and went out through the back screen door. As she moved between the bushes lining the walkway from the back of the house to the front, her hard, businesslike thighs broke twigs along the way. At the street, she saw Mr. Pud Allen going by in his wagon and hailed him and asked him to get the white people's doctor, Dr. Mason. Alice was unable to move Alexis from the chair and take her to her bedroom. When the doctor arrived, the two managed together to take her upstairs to the large front bedroom. The doctor said that it was most likely an inability to sleep that had caused Alexis's nervous attack. He sent Alice to the pharmacy for a medicinal draft to be mixed in water. Instructions were given that Alexis must rest. He told Alice to assure the woman's husband that she would certainly feel better soon. When Alice returned with the draft and began to mix it with water, Alexis stopped her. She handed her a letter.
"Read. Read what he has written," she said.
"I am gone. I have taken nothing except all that you had and all that others had. I have lost everything. You may say that I deserted you and get a divorce. The house in Philadelphia is still yours. All else is gone. Douglas." Alexis was grief-stricken and tearful, but she was not incapacitated. The circumstances of Douglas's financial ruin were hazy. He had lost all his money. He had lost most of hers. He had looted her inheritance, though he'd not been able to sell her father's house in Philadelphia. He had borrowed from his friends and lost that money, too. He had not been able to borrow against her house in Philadelphia because he could not bring himself to ask her to sign the papers. He had taken money in his position at the Treasury Department and had lost that money, too. He had simply left. Alexis had only the house in Philadelphia now, and she made arrangements to return there. Alice did the packing, though there was less to do than she would have thought. There was mostly clothes and small personal mementos. The jewelry of any value and the furniture had been sold to satisfy Douglas's debts. Alexis had dispassionately handed over her diamond engagement ring and other items Douglas had given her to the lawyer who was settling the accounts. There had been the suspicion that she had joined in Douglas's embezzlement and was possibly hiding some money. She had had to submit to a search of her belongings by the police and representatives of the Treasury Department. As she left the house for the train station, Alexis put a brooch in Alice's hand. The brooch was as round as a silver dollar and studded with tiny garnets. Alexis said they were garnets with a touch of apology in her voice. They were not diamonds. They were only garnets. The lawyers had taken all of the diamonds. As she got in the cab for the train station, she urged Alice to remember her.
"That woman didn't deserve that. She didn't deserve it," Alice said with heat and pity.
In her kitchen, she unwrapped four teacups with a floral pattern and the saucers that matched them. Alexis had pressed these on her, too. Alice turned them over in her hands one at a time. These cups and saucers, pretty and fragile, would remind her of Alexis.
"God doesn't think about what you deserve. He's got a plan,"
Ina answered, sucking a strand of cotton thread. She bent toward the lamp and drew the thread through a needle.
"Oh, hush up, Ina," Alice snapped. "What am I doing but telling the truth?"
Ina countered with wounded sensibilities.
"I don't want to hear about God's plan now, Ina. I'm talking about that man walking out on his wife like she was a common whore. That's what I'm talking about. He left her with only the clothes on her back, practically."
"She's got a big house in Philadelphia to sit up in."
"Ina May, what plans has God got for you, I wonder?"
Alice laughed wryly at her funny, contrary little cousin. She always thought of Ina May as younger, though she was fully 8 years older than Alice. Ina was the plump little girl who stood back on her heels and extended her arms to Alice when she toddled her first steps. Ina was the one who'd stayed behind gladly, watching the smaller children when others went to dances. Ina had been the one who'd always dreamed of a house full of children and had never had a single one.
"Well, the Lord made me colored, and on account of that, I'm not sitting up in a house in Philadelphia licking myself like a cat. I got to work for a living, whether my husband is alive or dead or playing possum, and you the same," Ina countered.
"Ina, you're being kind of cold-hearted. Don't you have any sympathy for that poor woman?" Alice said, only half teasingly. I save my sympathy for you. What you gonna do about your job? Instead of worrying about her, you ought to be worrying about yourself. What are you gonna do with those cups and saucers and that brooch? You can sell them, and when the money's gone, it'll be gone. Electricity came through Georgetown like a wave that same spring that the swimming pool was finished. Block by block, every house, big or small, palatial or pitiful, was wired to accommodate the incandescent bulbs. The gas street lamps were changed to the new electric light bulbs, and everybody in Georgetown, except the big-thighed Fontarellis, was glad about it. Electric light came through the same year that Georgetown got a swimming pool for colored and a colored lifeguard. The water in the pool and the lifeguard who was studying to be a doctor and the thrill of little round glowing globes of light to cut on and off gave Georgetown many things to look forward to. That same spring, the District of Columbia Recreation Department announced it was assembling teams of young swimmers to compete with teams from Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York. Neighborhood groups throughout town were grooming their best swimmers to compete to be on the citywide team. Charles Edward Hughes, a medical student at Howard University and the head lifeguard at the Francis Pool, organized swimming classes for the Georgetown children who came to the pool as soon as it opened. With a view to putting together a team, he gave each youngster a test to gauge his or her swimming abilities. Nobody was surprised that Johnny Mae Bynum emerged as the best of the girls. Charles Hughes, Charlie, they called him, praised her and made her the captain of the girls' team. Johnny Mae was, without doubt, the best female swimmer that Charlie Hughes had at the Francis Pool. In fact, she was the best swimmer, male or female, at the Francis Pool. Her mastery of the strokes was uniformly competent. He was surprised that she'd never had formal lessons. She was as close to a natural swimmer as Charlie had ever seen. Pearl Miller, Mabel Dockery, Sari Tyler, Dumpling Mason, Tiny Sham, Lula Lavery, and Johnny Mae Bynum came to the pool each day for lessons with Charlie Hughes. They all wanted to be as close to Charlie as possible. They had all been swept up in the newness and the adventure and the beauty of Charlie Edward Hughes and the swimming pool. Pearl was especially determined to learn the rudiments of swimming. But it was more as a means of preserving her friendship with Johnny Mae than from a passion for water. The water itself exerted no pull on her. It was the pull of the other girls, especially Johnny Mae. Sari Tyler, afraid of spoiling her pressed hair, spent most of the swimming lesson shielding her hair from the water. But she, too, basked in the glow of Charlie Hughes. Johnny Mae's swimming was fluid, graceful, all that it should be. Why, she could likely win against any but the absolute best swimmers. But it was in the diving that you saw the best of the girl. It was her absolute flawless ascent to the top of the diving tower, full of confidence, that made Charlie know she could compete and win. Only occasionally did she not connect well and falter enough to throw off the dive. These times were rare, and with practice, were becoming even more so. Johnny Mae's innate moxie was what took her off the board and sent her swirling gracefully through the air and into the water. She handled all the dives competently, but it was her utter willingness to jump that was so thrilling. Some who eventually jumped off the diving board would hesitate, sometimes for long moments, before deciding to take the plunge. But Johnny Mae was never unsure if she would jump. She would always jump. She would jump and descend to the surface of the water with a speed and force that belied the delicacy with which the water's surface parted to let her in. She seemed to break the surface with no more effort than the will to do it. breaking downward, then upward again, passing like a knife through butter. The first time Pearl saw Johnny May on the diving board, her form was silhouetted against a late afternoon sun, slipping down into Rock Creek. Pearl climbed toward the playground up the hill from Rock Creek, coming to the pool for her lesson and for the camaraderie. Johnny May stood on the diving board at the Francis Pool with an energy in her limbs that appeared to Pearl to emanate from the sun. She was struck by the sight of Johnny May. She didn't recognize her friend at first, but saw a tall, slim form standing higher than she'd ever seen a body stand. From where Pearl stood watching, trees obscured the platform on which the figure stood. Before the figure raised her arms, Pearl thought that it must be a statue she was seeing. When the figure left the end of the board in a perfect dive, Pearl drew in her breath and ran toward where she thought the figure must land, not realizing that there was water below her. Pearl stood back and watched Johnny May for a full hour that day. At times she squinted and threw her head back. Johnny May, completely absorbed in Charlie's assessment of each dive, didn't notice Pearl standing watching her from the fence. Pearl thought to herself that Johnny May didn't look like a graceful little swan when you saw her up close, but atop that diving board, it seemed as if she could jump off into the clouds. She became a part of the water when she entered it, and so her moving through it was effortless and completely without fear. Charlie knew about fear in the water. A river swimmer will know about fear because a river is not a captive. It moves and changes. It can fool you and take you down in a minute if you are not always paying it mind. And it is fear that seals the swimmer's fate. Flailing about to stay afloat is what sinks the swimmer. The not knowing how far to the land again and how far to the bottom. Fear of it makes water fathomless. Johnny May hopped on one leg to let the water run out of her ear. She changed legs and hopped, letting water run out of the other ear. There was a feeling like ants running up her back. She slapped at her shoulders and scratched her neck. It was like when you disturb an anthill and all the ants come running out. They think it's a fire. That's what Rat said. Rat said they looked like they were running away from a house on fire. And that afternoon, some summer afternoon that was like so many she and Clara had shared, Johnny May told Clara that they could really give the ants a taste of fire if they lit a match and stuck it down the anthill. The two girls looked all over the yard until they found an anthill. Johnny May struck a match that she scraped on the bottom of her shoe. It flared up. Rat got so excited that she bumped Johnny May's elbow. Johnny May told her she'd swat her upside the head if she didn't keep still. And Johnny May held the match steady and watched the flame eat up the matchstick, inching down toward her fingers. Then she jabbed the lighted match down the hole in the top of the anthill. Ants came running out like their house was on fire. Rat yelled because one or two climbed up her silly arm, and she jumped around to knock them off when she could have just slapped them off. Johnny May wanted to scratch and pull her swimming suit away from her skin, but Charlie had said she must stand still and think only about the water and how wonderful it would be to glide through it. He said to think about how proud everybody would be, especially him. He didn't say, especially him. He only said that everybody would be proud. She figured he meant to say he'd be especially proud of her, too, if she won. She wanted Charlie to be proud of her, and Mama, and Daddy, and Aunt Ina, and Pearl, and Rat. Rat, too. Rat must be proud, but Rat must be jealous as well. She wanted Rat to be a little jealous. She wanted Rat to look down on her from wherever she was and wish she herself was getting ready to swim. Rat couldn't swim. Johnny May didn't want to think about Rat now. But Rat couldn't swim. Didn't ever really swim. Rat was scared of the water, but always pretended that she wasn't. Rat never wanted to be left behind. She knew that Johnny May would leave her to go swimming, and Johnny May knew that Rat was truly scared of water, and she hadn't cared that day about her whiny little sister. She wouldn't think about Rat right now. Charlie said she didn't have to think about a thing at the time it flashed across her brain. Charlie said not to look at the girls next to her either. She was not to think about them and what they were going to do. Just listen for the starter's whistle, but don't look. Think about the swimming. Think about the swimming, the water. Just tell her arms and legs to wait for the whistle, then go. Tell her arms and legs to be relaxed, but ready, and bend down and stay loose, and let her body go and glide and be strong and glide into the water, and don't look back or to the side. Look down at the markers on the bottom and follow them in a straight line. And glide and push and breathe and glide and push and breathe. And look up, and Charlie's face will be there. And maybe Rat's face, too. When the starting pistol popped in the air above her head, Johnny May launched herself from the side of the pool with her toes. Her body unfurled above the surface of the water like a banner snapping in a sudden wind, then relaxing to float on ripples of air. She plunged into the water. The others must have also. She could neither see them nor hear them. It was her lane only, her water before her, and she plowed through it with all the energy she had. Afterward, Charlie said she'd lost it on the turn. She had been ever so slightly slower and wider in the turn than the other girl had been, and her fingers had touched home only a few seconds after the other girl's. But it had been after the girl. There had been a relieved sigh at the judges' table. The swimmers milled about while the judges had their heads together. They were bumblebeeing furiously. After a bit, one of the judges came forward and said that they were canceling the diving competition. He said they'd agreed that they had seen enough to make a pick. They didn't need to look at any diving. Charlie snatched the cap off his head and threw it to the ground in disgust. They'd got scared. They were scared because they knew. Those judges knew Johnny May could ace the diving competition. They'd seen how close she came to beating the other girl, and they were scared. If none of her competitors had been any good, then it would clearly have been a case of race prejudice. But they'd all been good. And the girl they chose to represent Washington was a nearly flawless swimmer. Her performance had been flawless in the swimming, but Johnny May would have beaten her in the diving, and the judges didn't want to see that. The deciders were not big people or risk takers. They were not bold enough in their prejudice to ban Johnny May outright. They had simply been grateful that their white swimmer was good enough. In fact, she was a little more than good enough. So they chose her and did not feel guilty. Chapter 18. In the past several months, all the energy in the Bynum household had been absorbed in getting ready for the coming baby. Johnny May was alternately happy at the progress her mother's stomach was making and repulsed by its mushrooming. Additional household duties had been pushed onto her, and she'd accepted them without complaint. Mama and Aunt Ina had planned it out that Mama would work at Ms. St. Pierre's as long as she could. Then Aunt Ina would work in her place until Mama was ready to take back her job. Johnny May was to help out with Aunt Ina's work and the household chores. All of this changed with the St. Pierre's financial troubles. Papa picked up extra work running the elevator at the Alban Towers Hotel in the evening. He was lighthearted, however, and unable to hide the pleasure this coming baby was giving him. As soon as the frost had passed and the ground was warm, he put in his vegetable garden. By the time the boy, Calvin William Bynum, was born, on the 6th of June, the tomato plants were beginning to twine around their stakes. Aunt Ina took charge of the household as soon as Mama's labor began in earnest. around 4 o'clock in the afternoon. She sent Johnny May up to Georgetown University to say to her papa, "Her time has come." Aunt Ina said it over and over with a solemn, no-nonsense demeanor, not allowing her excitement to change the pitch of her voice. Johnny May knew she was holding her voice steady by dint of great courage, because Aunt Ina's voice rose on the slightest provocation. "Her time has come. Go tell your papa her time has come." Johnny May was instructed to get her papa first, then go to Dr. Tyler's office and give him the same message. Willie got Peanut Walter, a tall, slow-moving boy who did pick up work for anybody, to work in his place at Alban Towers. The boy's name was actually Walter Peanut, and he was the oldest of Horace and Lila Peanut's 13 children. But he had always been called Peanut Walter around town. Johnny May was told not to dilly-dally, but to return as soon as she could. She was told to brew the pain-go-away tea that Ella Bromson had given to them, tied in a cheesecloth pouch. And she was told to fix a supper for her papa. Dr. Marvin Tyler delivered Calvin at the house in the early morning hours of Thursday. Aunt Ina had assisted him throughout the night while Johnny May sat at the top of the stairs outside her parents' bedroom door listening and trying to figure out what was actually going on inside. Mama didn't cry out, only grunted and exclaimed. When Johnny May was awakened by Calvin's first cries at 4 o'clock in the morning, she sprang to the door and tapped. Roused by Calvin's robust voice, Willie jumped up from his chair in the kitchen, took the stairs two at a time, and crowded in the bedroom doorway. Aunt Ina came and blocked the line of vision into the room. She sent Johnny May to fix her mother a bowl of cornmeal mush and a cup of coffee half filled with cream and lots of sugar. She pulled Willie into the room while clapping him hard on the back. "You got a boy, Willie. You got a son." Willie, the fifth wheel in the proceedings, had sat by himself in the kitchen the whole long night. He sat thinking about Clara and Big Mama and Merle. And he wondered who this coming baby was. If Clara had been his sister Merle come again, then who was this baby come again? If it was a girl, it would likely be Big Mama come this time, or his mama. But if it was a boy, he'd be somebody none of them had known. Unless it was his daddy, that he hardly could remember. Willie nursed many cups of coffee and pondered. With these coming children, we never relinquish the past. We keep seeing somebody gone in each new one. Willie couldn't say what part of Johnny May was the part she got from someone gone. He didn't know who that could be. He'd never known Alice's mama. He couldn't say if that damnable streak of independence was something she got honestly from her mother's mother or not. Now, Alice was pretty headstrong, but increasingly, there was something more intractable in Johnny May. She was daily getting more troublesome. He didn't know Sam Logan's people at all, except to know they were Redskins. Folks in Carolina always said that colored people with Indian blood were sullen and headstrong and clever. Johnny May was, he thought. That was what was in her, even from a little girl. Switching her bottom or the backs of her legs had been pretty much useless as a deterrent. The problem of her disobedience had never been in those places. It was in her head, hard-headed, headstrong. As expected, Ms. Fanny Maureen called just after 10 o'clock. Ms. Fanny, as she was affectionately known by any and all among colored who'd had a new baby or a child with cholera or influenza or rickets, was the licensed baby nurse assigned by the city health department to call on colored families in Georgetown. A fixture at church socials, Ms. Fanny always appeared neatly dressed in a sharply tailored black uniform and nurse's cap. Georgetowners admired her, especially for the courage with which she'd assisted Dr. Marshall and Dr. Tyler in the influenza epidemics in 2009 and 2012. Upon arriving at the Bynums' home, Miss Fanny drew off her black uniform jacket, undid her white cuffs, and put on the long white apron she pulled from her bag. She handed the jacket to Johnny May and instructed the girl to hang it neatly. Her loud, authoritative voice called Ina from the upstairs bedroom and brought her swiftly down the steps.
"Good morning, Miss Fanny,"
Ina called out cheerfully, but in a tone that gave Miss Fanny absolute jurisdiction in the house.
"Good morning, Miss Carson. We have a healthy big boy, I hear."
Miss Fanny had by this time marched into the kitchen. Ina was hard on her heels, and Johnny May followed. Miss Fanny perused the sink and swept her eyes over all surfaces on the stove, the table, and the cupboards. She judged the diligence of the household's women in stanching the tide of dirt and disease. Her eyes caught on the bundle of herbs that Ella Bromson had brought to be given to the new mother as tea.
"Miss Carson, we do not need backwoods remedies."
She pronounced her disdain for Ella Bronson's herbs with her nose and lips drawn up. Ina answered,
"Yes, ma'am, I'm sure you know the best."
Miss Fanny then reached in her medical bag and pulled out health department pamphlets on baby care and hygiene and instructed Ina to follow the recommendations to the letter. With her breasts high, she proclaimed the motto with which she concluded all her talks at the church programs.
"The health of our people is dependent upon the health of our children."
Johnny May was tickled by Miss Fanny's crusading fervor, but she knew she'd better not titter. Nobody dared laugh at Miss Fanny Maureen, for fear of being turned into the health department for keeping a household that was a menace to public health. Though Miss Fanny had been known to turn in only the worst cases of neglect and slovenliness in the 20 years she'd been working in Georgetown, it was widely known that she had the authority of the health department.
"Have mother and baby been bathed this morning?"
Miss Fanny asked as she put on her stethoscope.
"Oh, yes, ma'am,"
Ina said. She led Miss Fanny upstairs to the bedroom.
"The most important thing, Miss Carson, is to keep mother and baby clean and dry and well fed." "Oh, yes, ma'am."
Chapter 19.
"Her hair's always wet or nappy. It's a good grade of hair, and it's gonna be ruined from all that swimming in the pool. She smells funny. She's acting womanish and hard-headed, but behaving like a child, too. She's not carrying herself like a growing-up young lady, but still in all, she's over at that pool in a swimming suit instead of in her clothes. Maybe she's liking it too much."
In the kitchen, after Johnny May had gone to bed and Ina had gone home, Willie cudgeled Alice with his words. He was dancing up to a subject that he'd been trying to set to music for some time now. Alice heard the undercurrent of Willie's comments as clearly as if he'd said it out loud. He was trying to get it said that Johnny May, her daughter, was about to step out of line. He was trying to get it up to say that her daughter was being willful, like she had been. Alice seethed. Johnny May was completely absorbed with the pool and the competition. Yes, this was getting beyond the two of them, but Willie's intention wasn't pure. He wasn't talking about Johnny May's swimming. He was trying to get something said about her behavior, and Alice dared him with her eyes. He was a good man, but she wasn't going to allow him to oppress her with his goodness, because there was a meekness in his goodness that she had always thought unseemly. He loved her, but he had been too meek about it. He had waited for Alice and had got her with his meekness. She had wanted another man, but it settled for Willie. Now he was going to raise up on his hind legs at her. He was going to try to talk about her now. And her daughter. Alice dug in her heels. Willie could see Alice's determination to take her daughter's part, and he backed off.
"We can shinny that fence in no time, and you can stand lookout while I swim. We can do it any time. If we pick a night in the dark of the moon, nobody can see us."
Johnny May spoke with confidence, convincing Pearl that she was perfectly sure of herself. Pearl didn't see how the pool on Volta Place could still have a pull on Johnny May. The Francis pool was so much better, and she and anybody's colored child could swim in it whenever they wanted. Why was Johnny May so determined to swim in the pool on Volta Place? Johnny May loved the Francis pool. In fact, nobody could have loved it more than she. But there was a principle in this fever about the pool on Volta Place. There was something about the fact that the colored children were barred from it that inflamed her. Pearl didn't like the idea of scaling the fence in the dead of night, though. She started right away to run over all the dangerous possibilities in the plan, though she knew from the outset that she would go along if Johnny May kept insisting. And what kind of story would she make up to get out of the house past dark? Johnny May said the best plan was not to make up anything, but steal out after everyone had gone to sleep. On the chosen night, Johnny May lay in her bed and listened for her parents' snores. When finally the two became cadenced, sonorous snoring, Johnny May tiptoed out the back door and hightailed it to Volta Place. They'd chosen a night when Johnny May said there would be no moonlight. The darkness made it difficult to find a path through the trees to the fence that surrounded the pool, and they had to be careful not to step on and squash any of the stink balls that had fallen from the trees and littered the ground outside the pool. They hid their clothes a few yards from the fence. The fence provided excellent toe holds for scaling. Johnny May led the way as they climbed monkey fashion up the fence, hooking their hands and feet into the mesh. She left her shoes outside at the base of a tree, but Pearl kept hers on. Johnny May thought Pearl was a pampered sort of girl, but she proved herself full of stuffing in the way she scrambled up and over the top of the fence. As soon as they were over the top, Johnny May leapt to the ground. Pearl eased herself down a bit on the other side, then leapt off the fence, skinning her elbow as she landed. Though it stung, she didn't whimper. The water appeared black in front of them. In the darkness, there was no blue to it. Both jumped into the water and splashed great amounts of it onto the sides. The water had lost the warmth of the day's sun and was, as Clara had imagined it, cool. Maybe Rat was right after all. Maybe they did get blocks of ice to cool down the water. All the eyes and all the heads on all the pillows in Georgetown were closed, they thought. The only sounds were theirs. The trees overhanging the playground created a sylvan glade, and all sound from the street was muffled. There was no breeze to rustle leaves or ripple the surface of the water. It was only them and the pool. The sensation of slipping into water so dark that the blue bottom could not be seen was exhilarating to Johnny May. Pearl was frightened, though she was determined not to say so. She got out of the pool after a very few minutes and sat dangling her legs from the side. She was scared mostly because she couldn't see where the bottom was. She was nowhere near as confident of her swimming as Johnny May. Johnny May swam as easily in the dark as in daylight. She glided the length back and forth, and only the triangular trail her body made with her head forming the apex could be seen. Pearl watched her friend admiringly. Johnny May pulled herself to the side and raised herself out of the pool to the elbows, then dunked herself again and swam off. "You look like a shark," Pearl said as Johnny May barreled through the water. Johnny May put her head up at the far end of the pool and called back, "You don't know what a shark looks like. You better go back home, little girl. You better go get in your bed before your papa finds you gone." Pearl countered, sensing that, despite Johnny May's bravado, she was nervous about being in the pool. Johnny May shot up out of the water, ran back from the edge, then frog jumped back in. Her body made a roaring splash and sent water out along the sides. Pearl said, "Shh, don't be splashing around making noise." She sat on the side of the pool anxiously. Toby Davis wrapped his nightstick along the fence at the same time he yelled, "What's going on in there?" Pearl jumped in her skin at the rat-a-tat-tat sound and the booming voice. Johnny May, instantly alert, whispered, "Get down! Get down in the water so he can't see you!" Pearl slid down into the water quickly, then raised her head slowly, peeping up to see who was yelling. She saw a big, round, red face pushing up against the link fence. The policeman's eye was framed by a fence link. He shone his flashlight into the dark area around the pool to catch sight of whoever was swimming around in there. He'd heard splashing and was investigating. Wasn't nobody supposed to be cavorting around in there at night? "Niggers! What you niggers doing in that pool?" Toby Davis yelled out. The face left the fence, and Johnny May knew that Officer Davis was going to find a way in. They'd better scramble if they were going to avoid getting caught. There was no funnin' and gaming in Toby Davis's mind. Johnny May swam toward Pearl. "Go, run, get to the fence. He's gonna find a way in. Run, get out of here." Her voice came out strangled, but the force of it lit a fire under Pearl. Johnny May swam the width of the pool in nothing flat and jumped out. Pearl ran to the fence and climbed onto it. It bucked and threatened to throw her off, but she scrambled up and then down the other side. She heard Johnny May yell, "Run! Don't turn back! Just run!" Johnny May put her foot into the links halfway up and tried to mount the fence. She managed to get one foot secure, but Toby Davis, who'd squeezed through the gate at the back of the playground where it was held closed by a chain and a padlock, crossed the ground speedily and grabbed her right foot. The police officer bellowed, "Nigger, get down here! Get down or I'll shoot you off that fence!" Pearl's legs, which were readying to run, stopped cold. She turned and looked back, hidden by shrubs. Davis had Johnny May by one leg and was yanking and pulling her, trying to dislodge her from the fence. "You want to swim, nigger? You know niggers can't swim because niggers don't float." Officer Davis kept tugging on Johnny May's ankle, and she stubbornly held to the fence. The fence wobbled back and forth with the frantic tussling. Pearl's body went into that place of involuntary action that makes the body act because it cannot not act. She knew that Johnny May wouldn't be able to hold on to the fence much longer. She could see that Toby Davis was serious about holding on. Johnny May and Officer Davis were locked in the situation. Neither one of them was giving in, but Johnny May was likely to come out the loser. A few yards from the place the two girls had hidden their clothes, the ground was covered with stink balls, the fruit of the Japanese ginkgo tree. Most every block in Georgetown had some of the decorative ginkgo trees with their horribly stinking fruit. Stink balls lay all over the ground, waiting for somebody to step on them and release the putrid odor. Pearl grabbed up an armload of them and shinnied back up the fence. Despite the wobbling, Pearl gained the top and straddled it. From her perch, she lobbed a stink ball at Toby Davis, hitting him upside his head. The stink ball glanced off and smashed on the ground at his feet. It released a stinking smell, and Davis cursed. Pearl got tickled at his grimaces and threw more of the stinky things onto the ground at the policeman's feet. He stumbled around, stepping on the missiles and releasing their smell. Pearl leapt down, got more stink balls, mashed them between her palms to release their odor, and lobbed them over the fence on top of Toby Davis. Distracted by the stink balls, Davis loosened his hold on Johnny Mae's ankle. She hoisted herself up over the fence and down on the outside. Pearl, arms full of the stinking missiles, continued to hurl them onto the officer Toby Davis's head and shoulders.
"This ain't no game. I'ma get you, niggers. You got no business to be in this swimming pool."
Toby Davis sputtered with rage as Johnny Mae and Pearl grabbed up their clothes and ran down the street. When they got to the corner of Wisconsin Avenue and Volta Place, separating to go their different ways, Johnny Mae stopped to take a good look at Pearl's face. The girl was laughing, full out laughing, at what they'd done, at what she'd done. She had pelted Toby Davis all over his head with stink balls, and she was howling like a banshee about it. Johnny Mae grabbed at Pearl's shoulders and shook her, saying,
"Shush! You better stop hollering and laughing. You better hightail it home and get in the bed, little girl."
Pearl kept laughing. She ran off toward home with her head thrown back, laughing. The distance from Wisconsin Avenue to Johnny Mae's house seemed great. Out of all proportion to the usual distance, she'd run up and down these streets so often that she could recognize each cobblestone by its feel beneath her foot. But tonight, her feet were nearly numb. When she crossed Wisconsin Avenue, she started to run, and the feeling did not come back to her limbs even then. She felt instead that she was flying over the cobblestones and around the tree boxes. All of the windows and all of the houses were dark. She went down O Street and into the alley behind her house. The only house with a light on was her house. With the curtains drawn, the window looked like a square sun. She ran through the yard and up the porch steps, opened the door with a swift, desperate pull on the knob, and plunged headlong into the room. Her papa and mama stood when she entered. They stood and looked at her without saying a thing. Their faces indicted her for many and monstrous transgressions, but they wouldn't have thought of it, could not have imagined what really happened.
"You been swimming in the middle of the night? Your clothes is all wet through. You been walking in the streets like this all night. Johnny Mae, you hear me?"
Papa broke the silence.
"Johnny Mae, has something happened to you?"
Mama asked. Her face was all torn up.
"My Lord, what's going on?"
Mama exclaimed, and Calvin, who'd awakened at the sound of the loud voices, joined his strident voice to the others.
"Has somebody done something to you, girl?"
Papa asked, his voice climbing higher in volume and pitch.
"I'm calling the law."
"No, something happened, but not what you think,"
Johnny Mae answered.
"What happened, Johnny Mae? Where have you been?"
Mama asked.
"A girl gets up in the middle of the night and goes tramping through the town.
Anything is bound to happen. What is it?"
She bowed her head in the face of her papa's voice.
"Where your shoes at, girl?" Mama asked. "What happened to your shoes?"
Johnny Mae had not thought about the shoes since she took them off before climbing the fence. Where were they? Still on the grass by the fence? They were still where she'd left them, and she'd come all the way home without them, without even noticing that she'd forgotten them. She looked down at herself, bare feet, dress wet. What a shameful sight. Her papa said,
"Has something been done to her? I'll kill the man that's done it. I'll call the law. Alice, I depend on you to tell me if this child has been taken advantage of."
Fearing the direction their fears were taking them, Johnny Mae